Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the former Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. Currently, he's the Executive Director of Public Lands Media. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He has published 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrucraft, Energy, and most recently, Protecting the Wild. So as always, George, thank you so much for your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. I always appreciate the opportunity to speak about issues with you.
Great. Well, that works out because there's another issue that we're going to talk about today, which is grayling, which an Arctic grayling, which a lot of people may not have heard of. Can you talk about that fish?
Yes. Arctic grayling are, as the name implies, a species that's found around the world in the boreal realm. So you find it across North America, up in Canada and Alaska. You find it in, you know, Asia, as well as Northern Europe. And it's somewhat related to whitefish and trout. And in that regard, it likes cold water. And it's fairly abundant up north where there's been little degradation. But there were some populations that reached their southern limits, one population in Michigan and the other population in Montana, as a result of the Ice Age glaciers. And it's a pretty cool thing that happened. In Montana, the story goes like this. The Missouri River used to flow north all the way up to Hudson's Bay, or the predecessor of today's Missouri River, which starts in Montana. And it is thought that via that river system, grayling got established in the state of Montana, and relic populations were able to survive in the cold water headwaters of the Missouri River. Those headwaters are not called the Missouri River. It's rivers like the Big Hole River, the Sun River, the Smith River, the Ruby River, the Red Rock River. But they're all tributaries. The Gallatin River is another one. They're all tributaries of the Missouri. And it's really cool. If you look at a map of Montana, you'll see that the Missouri River flows north through Helena and Great Falls and then makes a 90-degree turn to the east. So it's flowing north up to that point. And where it makes its 90-degree turn to the east is the southern edge of the Continental Glaciers. And so what happened was this river that used to flow up to Hudson's Bay got diverted as the glaciers came south and found a new way to the ocean going east and eventually joining the Mississippi and out to the Gulf of Mexico.
So wait a second. Wait a second. Yeah. So what happened was it was flowing north, because I was going to ask you how precisely it switched, because that seems weird to traverse a continental divide, basically traverse a continental divide. So basically what happened is that the glaciers dammed it when it was going north. It probably filled up into a lake and then overflowed to the east and south and cut a channel that ended up being lower after the glaciers receded. Is that accurate?
That's exactly what happened.
Okay.
And then it was stuck in that channel heading to the Mississippi instead of, you know, going northwards. And so these fish, the Arctic grayling, became Ice Age relics in these headwater streams. I'm not quite sure what the story is with the fish in Michigan, except that I know that they went extinct due to excessive logging that caused sedimentation in the streams. And the grayling are very sensitive, you know, they need clean water, cold water, and that's what eliminated the grayling from Michigan. And in Montana, they were isolated. I mentioned these other rivers, the Sun River, the Smith River, a number of them that the grayling used to be found in, they are no longer found in. And they were left in the Big Hole River in particular, and Red Rock Lakes Wildlife Refuge, upper tributaries to that, were the two main populations that were left, and some in the Madison River too, which is also a tributary of the Missouri. And so the sad story is that, like a lot of things, the grayling population decline due to a lot of insults from humans. One is they tend to be long-distance migrants, spending their winters in very deep holes in the rivers, with generally with springs coming up. And then in the spring, they will migrate 50, 60, maybe 100 miles. In the old days, we don't know, but even fish today go 50, 60 miles, and will then ascend tributary streams where they spawn. And then the fingering spend time, the young fish, in those tributaries before migrating down to the main rivers, where they again overwinter in the deep holes. Well, we've done several things. One, on a lot of these rivers, we've built dams, which blocks that migration pattern. A lot of the relic populations are in places with dominated by livestock raising, and they have impacted the tributary streams where the spawning happens by, eliminating the riparian cover, which makes them warmer, breaking down the banks, which makes the streams shallower, and has less cover for hiding, for the small fish to hide from other predators. And then there is the problem that in the summertime, in these remaining relic population zones like the Big Hole River, the ranchers dewater the streams so severely that the remaining fish, first of all, the streams that the small fish are in will often dry up, so they don't ever get to the main river. And then even in the main river, so it's so dewatered that it concentrates all the fish in very small pockets. And so there, the grayling that do survive have to compete with all these other fish, including introduced trout, brown trout and rainbow trout, which are not native to the rivers there. And the interesting thing, this is an interesting behavioral thing. They used to think that the exotic trout were negatively impacting the grayling by basically, taking over the best feeding sites and getting more feed and so forth. But what they found out was that the grayling were very aggressive about, capturing these best feeding spots, but they spent so much time chasing the exotic fish that they weren't feeding as much. So they had this behavioral change where they had to, sort of constantly fight for their position in the current, and wound up, actually feeding less, even though they're in a good spot for feeding. So because of these multiple abuses, you might say, the grayling population has been in decline. And back in the early 90s, I was contacted by three Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks fishery biologists, all independently. They didn't, because they were doing it in secret. They didn't know the other guys were contacting me. But they all asked that I try to get the grayling listed under the Endangered Species Act, because they felt that their department was not doing enough to counter all the multiple impacts on the grayling, and it was their fear that grayling would eventually go extinct. And I was able to work with another person who's more of an expert on how do you petition for listing than I was at the time, and groups like the Center for Biodiversity weren't around. And we petitioned to have the fish listed in 1991. So think about that, where we are now. It's still not listed. And we've had multiple lawsuits since that time, been joined by other groups like the Center for Biodiversity, Western Watersheds Project, and a few others in helping to raise the profile of the fish. But they, the Fish and Wildlife Service, as you know, is a political agency for high-profile species. And the ranchers in Montana, in particular, do not want to see the fish listed for the obvious reasons that I just mentioned, that it, at least the complicating factors are lack of water for fish. That's an important thing. And then the impacts to tributaries where the spawning takes place. If the fish is listed, there would be a legal requirement that those factors be corrected. And so they don't want to see it listed. Anyway, due to their political influence, they have successfully gotten the species listing delayed multiple times through various subterfuges. One was to put together a conservation plan that was supposed to improve things for the grayling, and the Fish and Wildlife Service then used that conservation plan to deny listing. In other words, they have a thing called warranted but precluded, and the warranted but precluded decision means that they do think the fish will go, or any species will go, extinct, but they, for various reasons, aren't going to list it at this time. Often they say there's other higher priority species, or in the case of the grayling, they say, well, let's see if this conservation plan will work. And so, you know, it takes a long time to see if it'll work. I think it was about 10 years it managed to delay any kind of discussion or listing. And then we succeeded on and off through various lawsuits to get it a decision that it indeed needed to be listed, and then it was the decision was reversed capriciously, as they say in the courts, and now it's up for another look for listing, perhaps within the next year. Meanwhile, the grayling has a population in the main areas where it is still found, like the Big Hole River, has continued to decline. The last time I looked, and I haven't looked in the last year or so, but last time I looked, the population had declined to the point where there was approximately one or two adult fish per mile of river. And those who champion how well the conservation plan works, they always include all the young fish of the year, most of which don't survive. So they'll tell you, oh, we have 300 fish or 400 fish per mile or whatever the number might be. But that's deceptive because the young fish don't reproduce. And so you have to look at your adult population of mature fish that can reproduce to determine what the status of the fish is. And this is not to say that, I just want to put in one point.
Yeah, please.
Okay, just that some of the conservation things that were done were good, just not good enough. For example, they put in some screening on irrigation ditches to keep grayling from being, you know, just set out in a field where they die. They have done some things with water where they've got agreements to allow more water to go in the river. It's just not enough in drought years. The conservation plan, you might say, is a step in the right direction. It's just not nearly enough to save the fish.
The only point I was going to make, thank you for all that. The only point I was going to make was that I don't remember the term. What's the term that fisheries biologists use for it's B-O, big old fat female fish? Is that it? those are the ones that you really care about because they're the ones who reproduce
right.
the most. Did I have that right at all?
I don't know what the term is either, but you're on the right pathway. Certainly that's the gist of what the saying is that, you know, one mature fish, big female, is worth, you know, a dozen smaller fish because they can produce so many more eggs.
Or in this case,
you're correct in that.
They're worth hundreds of the little fish, because the little fish, as with a lot of species like that, the little fish don't survive to become adults very often.
Even in the normal course of things. Yeah,
the
recruitment is what the term that they use. The recruitment is what's into adult fish is what's important, not the total reproduction, because as you know, and in true in all different species, there's a lot of mortality of young fish or young, you know, mammals or whatever it is we're talking about. And so what you have to look at is how many adults that can reproduce are actually left standing after everything is said and done. And that's what we're seeing as a real decline. And the problem on the Big Hole in particular, which is the river that has the most intact habitat, the Arctic grayling are just barely hanging on, and part of it is, you know, I go there in drought years, and the river is just like a riffle going into a pool, going into another, you know, riffle and another pool. In other words, it's dramatically dewatered. And as across the West, irrigators are permitted to degrade river ecosystems basically at will. And an important thing for listeners to know, because this is true throughout the West and I'm aware of every Western state, the water in rivers is not owned by irrigators. You hear about irrigation rights. The rights are that if you do take water out of the river, who gets to use it and what amount? But whether you take water out of the river is up to the citizens of the state, because they are the ultimate owners of it. And in all Western states, we have allowed irrigators, who are primarily livestock producers in most states, to take the water out of the river at no cost. They don't pay anything for that water. So the citizens of Montana don't get any money or funding as a result of that water removal. And they get to use it to the point where a lot of times streams, particularly tributary streams, are dried up completely. And that is a huge environmental degradation. That's another cost. That's, you know, both of these are subsidies in effect. The subsidy is they don't pay anything for the water. And then we get huge environmental degradation to our river systems and our fisheries and everything dependent on. Keep in mind that when the fish population declines, that's less fish for mink or river otter or bald eagles and osprey and kingfisher and all kinds of other wildlife that depend on that fish. So we're having a big impact on our wildlife, and we're having a big impact on the riparian vegetation, which also, by the way, depends on having full flow in the streams. And as you as the water flows decline, that shrinks the riparian area, which then affects things like songbirds that nest in, you know, willows and cottonwood trees. I mean, it's an incredible degradation that nobody talks about. For example, in the issue with the grayling, this may surprise some people, probably doesn't surprise you, Derek, but those opposing listing included Montana Trout Unlimited, joining in with the Montana Fish and Game Department to oppose listing of the grayling. And you know, when you've got friends like that, it makes it a lot harder to, you know, do good things for the wildlife. And of course, their argument is we have to work with these ranchers, because they won't even challenge the idea that the ranchers have any, quote, right to take the water out of the river. So that's a battle they don't want to get into. And there's reasons to believe that that would be a very difficult battle. Nevertheless, most people are totally unaware of it. And I tend to think if more people realize that the water in Western rivers belongs to the citizens of the state, not to ranchers and irrigators, that there would be at least pressure to have more equal distribution of that water. In other words, you might be able to get the irrigators to concede that you've got to keep 50% of the flow in the Bighorn River, even in a drought year, for example, to maintain the aquatic ecosystem. But right now, we give that up. We give that that legal card, that public relations card up, because they won't even talk about it.
I interviewed someone that I didn't air the interview because of this. I interviewed a mainstream environmentalist once about a particular river, and one of the things that this mainstream environmentalist, and I'm using mainstream pejoratively here, one of the things that this mainstream environmentalist kept insisting over and over was that there is enough water for everyone. And so this person was saying that there's enough water for the fish and the cattle and the farmers. And I pointed out that, well, if that's the case, then A, why are the fish going extinct? And B, why does the river no longer reach the ocean? And the point I'm making here is that this was like 2 years ago, and a mainstream person who identifies as an environmentalist was still arguing that there's enough water to just take as much as you want and to give as much as you want to everybody, basically. And I'm sure you've encountered that too. It's horrifying as you said, with friends like that.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. And you know, it's so the proportion of use is so out of equality, so to speak. Here in Montana, 97% of the water that's removed from rivers is for agriculture. 97%. I mean, in other words, any water that all the cities use, Billings, Bozeman, et cetera, or industry uses, is the under 3%. I mean, it's pretty insignificant. If all you had was cities using water here, we wouldn't have an issue with Grayling or any other thing. And most of that agriculture in a northern state like Montana is used for growing hay primarily and forage for livestock. There's a little bit of irrigated sugar beets and corn in a few parts of the state. But for the most part, if you look at what the percentage is, it's the bulk of all that water removed goes for growing livestock feed. And that's true in every single Western state, even California, despite the fact that, you know, California grows half the food in the country and a lot of the crops there, lettuce, et cetera, you know, strawberries, they're probably all irrigated. But that's a small percentage, even in California, of the water use. The bulk of the water in California is used for livestock pasture and hay production. So, you know, there might be enough water to go around if you got rid of the livestock. And you only have the remaining uses. But as long as we're growing livestock with that scarce water in desert environments, that's just a crazy use of water in a scarce resource like water in places that are relatively arid. And all the Western states fit that pattern. And the other part about it that's, and I'm not necessarily advocating livestock production in other parts of the country because there's impacts there too, but the irony is we grow, you know, if we wanted to grow cattle or whatever in this country, we could get all the cattle we need and want grown in places where it rains. So we don't need to be using water in desert areas in dry, arid valleys to grow alfalfa or hay. It's an insane use of, and you know, you hear this stuff from defense from quote the wise use movement, but that's not a wise use at all. Anybody who looked at it rationally would say, well, it's crazy to be growing cattle in the desert. You know, we can grow them in places like Missouri or Virginia, in fact, where the bulk of livestock are produced in the eastern states, and do so without having to drain rivers to grow the cattle and for, you know, draining them irrigation water.
So I want to go back to something you said early on, and this is something that you and I both probably know pretty well, but I would like for you to really introduce this to the larger public, that just the insanity of, you know, you said 1991, I believe, which is 28 years ago, and this is not particularly surprising. Can you talk about... I keep thinking of the Ansel, I believe it's Ansel Adams, isn't it, who had the quote about it's crazy that you have to sue the government to protect nature?
I don't know who said that, but it's true.
And
yes, it's yeah.
Yeah, and so can you, you know, when people listening to this might go, oh, Fish and Wildlife, they're the ones who do the Endangered Species Act, and they're the ones who are on our side, and they're really friendly, and they, but they have to be sued, and... I mean, can you talk about can you introduce people to the complicated or the Rube Goldberg route can you I'll do just value neutral. I'll be a good person. Can you introduce people to Fish and Wildlife, Endangered Species Act, and how people often have to sue the government to protect wild animals or wild species?
Yes. Yeah. It's important to understand, I think, that many of the people working for, say, the Fish and Wildlife Service or even Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks are sympathetic to protecting these species. I mean, after all, it was three biologists at the department that called me up independently to get me to try to list the grayling. However, And in fact, with the Grayling, we got a at one point in time, you know, this has gone back and forth so many times, I can't even keep it straight when it happened. But we got a decision that the Grayling should be listed, and it got to the Denver office where it got reversed by political meddling. And so, you know, the field biologists agreed with us that it should be listed. So you have to understand that. So within this sort of cat and mouse game, which is what it is, a lot of times these biologists are either counting on or hoping that somebody will sue their agency. And it's an unfortunate fact of life. But they know, because of the politics, that ultimately they need to have somebody sue to bring about the protection. And there's suing has two aspects to it. One, it gets the people working in these agencies who want to do the right thing. It gives them the political cover to do it. In other words, they can go out to, you know, the ranchers in the Big Hole Valley and say, well, we're sorry, guys, but, you know, and I'm really sympathetic to your irrigation and so forth. We like you guys. But the darn court is telling us that we have to have more water in the river. And so, you know, so they can use that as an excuse. So you get the good guys, get political cover, and then the guys who are really bad guys get forced by the judicial system to implement changes that are beneficial, whether they like it or not. And so this is one of the things when people are criticizing, oh, these environmental groups, and they're usually the smaller groups, not the big groups, are suing this and that, and it's a frivolous lawsuit, you find all this stuff. Yeah, there was an editorial today in the Bozeman Chronicle from Senator Daines talking about how we have to eliminate frivolous lawsuits stopping timber sales. And you know, the thing that the senator overlooks is, why are the environmental groups that are doing the lawsuits winning? Because the agency's breaking the law. I mean, so in a sense, he's saying, we want to allow these agencies to continue breaking the law, and we don't like it when somebody stops them from breaking the law. So I think the lawsuits are the, you know, the measure of last resort, because other methods just generally don't work. And so it's a good thing that we have these laws, which, of course, the opponents and those who want to do resource extraction and exploitation realize that. That's why they're currently, particularly the Trump administration, is working very hard to either neutralize and or eliminate a lot of the regulations and so forth that are out there. And I think it's important for people to understand that environmental regulations are, if they're done well, and I would agree there's some that probably could be better, but if they're done well, the idea is to try to internalize the real costs. So when these ranchers drain a river and they destroy the river ecosystem, that's a cost to everyone, and that's a cost that they're not paying. So if for example, the Grayling is listed, and if after listing we succeed in getting some changes in flow rates in the Big Hole River and other streams with Grayling, that would be rectifying this environmental cost that subsidizes their business operations. And so we have to realize that a lot of times the regulations are there to internalize these costs that are currently externalized and allow businesses to, you know, make money at the expense of the environment and everybody else, and taxpayers in many cases.
I also want to highlight a phrase you mentioned earlier, which is one that I've heard many times over the decade and which still horrifies me, is I believe it was warranted but precluded.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about the possible extirpation of a species, that phrase is obscene.
Well, exactly. The rationale behind it, and this is another way opponents of protecting the environment work, the rationale behind it is, we don't have enough funds or money to either investigate a species, which to me is the real irony. You know, it's going extinct, and you say, well, we can't really do the science to determine whether it's going extinct, so we won't list it. Seems like the precautionary principle, you would list it first, and then if you find that the science doesn't prove it or proves that it isn't necessary, then you unlist it. But that's not how it works. But nevertheless, the whole thing behind it is, one of the reasons they have a problem is that the opponents of the Endangered Species Act, among the many ways that they try to make it ineffective is by limiting the budget of the Fish and Wildlife Service to do these reviews. So when they say it's precluded, warranted but precluded, they're saying, well, we think this species is going to go extinct, but we have other species that we have to study or should be listed first, but we only have so much money to do this. And again, I don't want to be quoted on this, but I think it's like $10 million or $15 million. I could be off a lot. But the amount of money that they spend doing endangered species listing reviews is incredibly small within the total budget of the federal government. And you know, we easily spend incredibly amount more, you know, on ag subsidies. I believe ag subsidies this year, in addition to the normal subsidies, the Trump administration has spent $22 billion, I think it is, giving farmers more aid because of his tariff war. You know, $22 billion, if we put that to doing reviews for endangered species, we'd clear the whole deck, I think.
We'd probably clear the deck in about a week.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so it's one of the ways you preclude listing is make sure there isn't enough money to do the proper legal reviews. And because the way the system is set up is you have to, it's the benefit of the doubt or the burden of proof, I should say, is on those proposing listing rather than on those opposing listing. In other words, I have to prove that the grayling are going extinct to get it listed. Those who are opposed don't have to prove that it isn't going extinct. So, you know, it really makes it harder to get species listed. And as I said, a rational way would be to list the species and then have the opponents spend their time trying to prove that it isn't warranted. You know, I could live with that kind of a system, but that's not the system we have.
So let's pretend, let's go back to the grayling. And, mm-hmm. You know, I was doing some research on this before our conversation, and there are accounts from the 1938, actually there's accounts from the 1890s of people saying, gosh, there were grayling here and now there's not. And there's a book, The Waters of Yellowstone with Rod and Fly. Howard Back in 1938 said he was no longer able to find any grayling in the Madison River. And so when you make your case for the grayling, is that the sort of stuff that you do, or do you have to start from scratch and say, okay, we now need to do a study that shows in 1991 there are, you know, 10 fish per mile, and in you wait until 1997 when there's only one fish per mile? I mean, how does that actually work?
Well, you do all that, actually. You get historical accounts showing the distribution historically and how much it has shrank, because one of the aspects of the Endangered Species Act says that when a species has declined over, and the wording is exactly a significant portion of its geographical range, then that warrants listed. So one of the things you do is exactly what you're talking about. You go around and you say, well, you know, the grayling was found in the Smith River and the Sun River and, all, you know, the Madison River and all these other streams, and now it's not there anymore. So that's a significant reduction in its range. That alone would be a good reason for listing under the Endangered Species Act. But, of course, the burden of proof is much higher. So then you have to show that, you know, the fish is declining and how much a year. And that, and like all wildlife populations, that decline is a trend. In other words, any one year you can go out and you might find, oh, grayling numbers are up this year, but then, you know, the next year they're down. But overall the trend is downward. And so that becomes an important piece of evidence for listing. And then, you know, and then listing, of course, generally affects primarily the federal land. So that would be a complicating factor with the grayling, because a lot of the grayling habitat is on private lands, but the tributaries, particularly the spawning tributaries, for the most part are on federal lands, BLM or Forest Service land. Bureau of Land Management is what BLM stands for, and where federal government restrictions might be imposed on, say, cattle grazing in riparian areas. There may be efforts to mandate minimum flows in the Big Hole River to protect the grayling. So there are some things that could be done even though some of the habitat is on private lands.
And another process that you and I are both very familiar with, I'm sure, is the notion of creatures being studied to death, by which I mean they will say, we need to do more studies, which sometimes is true. We do need to do more studies, but sometimes that's really code language for, you know, I heard this back in the early 90s. I was testifying about removing some of the dams on the Columbia, which obviously haven't happened. And there was a great quote by one of the people, what was it called? The Pacific Power Planning Council or something like that. There was a great quote by one of the industry members on that where he said, I wish that the salmon would just go extinct so that we could get on with living. And there is this, sometimes again, more studies are necessary. And then sometimes, can you talk about this use of this as a tactic? We need to study it for a few more years. Oh, one more thing I want to say about this is a joke that I've told many times. It's usually received pretty well. Is I talk about, I think it was Plato talking about how deforestation was harming water quality in ancient Greece. And after I say that, I say, yeah, and I'm guessing that the equivalent of the Greek Department of Environmental Quality said we need to study this for a few more years and make sure there's really a correlation. And everybody would laugh because this is what happens today. Anyway, can you go on about that for a couple minutes?
Well, I actually think that's what's going on with the grayling, that there's a sense that the longer we can delay this, eventually the problem will go away. In other words, there won't be any grayling left to worry about, and then we're home free. And I think, I mean, I can't say that that's what the ranchers and the opponents of listing are hoping, but it certainly could be the outcome. And exactly as you said, initially, and there has been a lot of research on grayling. That's the good thing. We have a much better understanding of how the grayling ecology works and how these rivers work as a result. But again, my way of doing things would be to list it and do these studies, and then if the studies prove that the solutions that you have proposed under listing, let's say it was listed and I said, well, part of the problem is grazing of riparian areas and degradation of spawning sites, you know, maybe they'd study that and find, well, that's not really the problem. Okay, so we can modify the, you know, recovery plan so it doesn't include any kind of limits on grazing and riparian areas. But that's not the process. It's all up front. You have to do the studies before listing, and that becomes a way of delaying what happens. And I am, you know, I know privately, I've known some of the biologists working for Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks after the people that contacted me, in other words, after our petition to list it, were privately cheering us on. And so you have to recognize that a lot of these guys are, and women, as the case may be, are in a difficult situation because the politics of such, you know, the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks is under the thumb of the Montana legislature, and the Montana legislature is made up of a disproportionate amount of ranchers and farmers, and they have a huge political influence on what happens to the department and wildlife in this state. And so, you know, that's the status quo, and that's what you're dealing with. That's why you need outside intervention. That's what the Endangered Species Act would require. It would require the federal government, which is supposed to represent all people's interests, not just the ranchers or the people in Montana, but all the interests in the country and globally, in protecting species and trying to keep them from going extinct. And as you know, if the fish go extinct in some of these rivers, they'll probably, you know, have some left in a hatchery and try to reintroduce them or whatever. And sometimes that works, but it's a lot better and a lot cheaper to maintain the fish in the first place. And unless you change the habitat, degradation, you know, stocking hatchery fish is not going to be an ultimate solution.
So we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and there's a couple things I want to ask about. One of them is, you know, I've known, and I'm sure you have too, known some biologists, and I'm saying that term with scorn in my voice right now, some biologists who are, you know, actively, who are really nasty and who will sign off on anything. We've both known some of those, I'm sure. And then there are also, as you've said, all these really good ones. And I just, I want to, can you comment for a minute on this whole notion? You've really talked about it, but just how difficult that would be to actually love the species, but then work for an organization that's been captured by industry. You know, if you went into the, some of them are just nasty. I've known some of them, but others really, honestly, as you say, love the species, and they went into biology because they love wildlife, and then they end up, in order to get a job, you know, I mean, the grayling are not by themselves going to hand over cash to these people to pay their rent. And so they end up working for an organization that's oftentimes been captured by... Oh, I want to say one more thing, and then I'll shut up on this, which is that I have a good friend who's a fisheries biologist for the local national forest. And the local national forest has traditionally been one of the few that I actually just... I'm really happy with how they manage the national forest here. And the reason is because they don't have a cattle grazing program, and they don't have a timber sale program. So they can actually do what they're supposed to do, which is to take out old roads. He can actually honestly help the biology, I mean, help the fish, as opposed to having to sign off on timber sales. And just how difficult that would be to work for an organization if you love wildlife, and then to work for an organization that is supposed to help wildlife and doesn't. That's all. It must be difficult.
Yes, it is. And I have a lot of friends that have, you know, some still working for the agency, some that are retired, but they are out there and they do have a difficult time because, as you say, most people go into forestry or wildlife biology or botany or any of these field kind of things, not really in range. I would say that's an exception. But most of the ones that go in the other fields do so because they have a love of nature. And they genuinely want to help nature out, but the range of employment opportunities are pretty limited. Most people are going to wind up working for federal agencies or state agencies, and these agencies are political entities. And the way that many of them rationalize it, and it's not an absurd rationalization, is that if they weren't there, things would be worse, because they do try to minimize, in a lot of cases, the worst negative effects. However, they would also tell you, at least the ones that love the wildlife and ecosystems, they would also tell you that they really, really need the backup of citizens that provide them the cover so that they can make these kinds of changes. And I think that that's one of the things that a lot of conservation groups don't realize. There's a lot of fighting among conservation groups where they talk about these extremist groups that are filing lawsuits all the time. And I got to say, I think most of those people in those conservation groups never worked for a federal agency and don't know that many people, because if you talk to the people in the federal agency, a lot of them will say, thank God somebody's filing a lawsuit, because that's what I need to be able to say what I need to say. I'll just give you one small example, if I have a moment. I was out on a collaborative a couple years ago in Oregon, and the district ranger was looking at a place that he was planning to thin, and they were going to put in a bunch of logging roads to do the thinning. And the whole justification, he said, was, well, if we have a wildfire here, we're going to get sediment in the stream. We want to prevent that, so we're going to do this logging. And I pointed out to the group that logging roads were the biggest source of sedimentation in most rivers in the western U.S., where there isn't livestock grazing, and sometimes you have both. But in the areas that are logged, the chronic source of sedimentation comes from logging roads. And the district ranger, you know, he had never heard that, apparently, which, again, is surprising. But anyway, he turns to the hydrologist that was also on this field trip, who up to this point had not said a single word, even when the district ranger made this absurd statement. And he said, you know, Hank, is that really true that logging roads are a big source of sedimentation? And the hydrologist said, well, actually, it is true. And then he kind of launched into a little spiel about logging roads. But if I hadn't been there, that would never have been said. But I provided the sort of, you might say, the political cover for him to speak out without jeopardizing, in a sense, his position in the agency, because he was asked to, you know, respond to a question. And so I think people have to realize a lot of the effort of conservation groups, the good kind of lawsuits and questioning things, is giving backup to people, the good people in these agencies that want that backup and cover. And that's certainly how I operate. I try to give agency people the benefit of the doubt until they prove otherwise. Like you say, there's some nasty ones out there. When I don't hold back. But initially, at least, I try to say what I think is needs to be said. And I oftentimes I see these guys smiling or these women smiling when I'm talking, because, you know, a lot of them are well aware of the information that I'm conveying. They just they're not going to be the ones to volunteer it.
And also, that's, you know, I've been with organizations where they have received, well, this is dating me, because this is back in the early 90s before cell phones were really around, but they would get phone calls from payphones, literally sort of that cloak and dagger sort of stuff, phone calls from payphones saying, when you get the document, make sure to look very carefully at pages 64 through 68.
Right.
And, I mean, yes. There are those. Go ahead.
Well, I would agree with you. And, in fact, that is the there are various ways that state and federal personnel can help out protecting the land. And that is certainly one. I'll relay. Do I have time, about 2 minutes to relay anymore, or am I just about up?
No. We got 2 minutes for that. And then okay. I want to ask about what people can do for grayling.
Okay.
And we've got like 4 minutes total, so you're good.
Okay. Yeah. I'll tell you an experience. Refuge manager in Oregon who managed the Heart Mountain Sheldon Wildlife Refuge in Nevada. His name was Barry Ricewick. He's since retired from the Fish and Wildlife Service. But he realized that livestock raising at the refuge was having a detrimental effect on the livestock. So what did he do? I mean, on the wildlife. So what did he do? He invited various researchers to come and look at the, you know, effects of livestock on riparian areas or nesting sage grouse and various other, you know, effects on pronghorn, etc. And then he started going around to population centers, not the little rural towns in Oregon, but, you know, places like Reno and Portland and Eugene, talking about how removal of livestock might benefit the wildlife there. And I was involved in a group of people that were meeting at Heart Mountain one time to talk about livestock grazing impacts. And Barry drives up in his pickup truck, Fish and Wildlife Service pickup truck. He's got his full uniform on and everything. He says, so what are you guys doing? And, of course, I knew Barry from when he worked in Montana at Red Rocks Wildlife Refuge, so I knew he was a pretty good guy. But most of the people there didn't. So they were a little worried or suspect about saying what we were meeting about. Finally, you know, we mentioned a few things. Finally, somebody says, well, we're talking about grazing on the refuge. And Barry says, well, you know, I've been looking into that question, and the original language that created this wildlife refuge said that the primary purposes for wildlife and all other uses are secondary and cannot harm the primary purposes, and the primary purposes is wildlife. And he said, if you took me into a court of law and asked me if livestock grazing was having a negative impact on the wildlife, he said, well, I'd have no choice but to tell you yes. And then he turned around and he walked away. And there were three lawyers in the group. And it was like, here's our roadmap. What we have to do is file a lawsuit and get Barry into court. And it's pretty clear cut. Anyway, that's an example of how somebody can work within the system. And he had the science that the scientists had done showing the impacts. He had the political backing of people when the locals tried to get rid of him as the refuge manager. You know, people in Portland and Reno and so forth were writing letters to the Fish and Wildlife Service. We like Barry. Don't get rid of him. And so that's a very strategic way that he was able to make changes. And there's no livestock at Heart Mountain Wildlife Refuge anymore. And I attribute a lot to Barry's efforts.
So thank you for that. And so we've got like a minute or so left, and let's take it back to grayling. And we've been talking about lawsuits and all sorts of stuff that frankly, might be intimidating to a lot of people. So what actually can, what do you want, why did we do this interview, and what do you want anybody listening to it to get out of it, and how can they help the Grayling?
Well, you know, I wanted them to understand the larger issue of water use in the West. That's almost more important, because it's not just grayling that are impacted by dewatering. All sorts of fishery species, something like 47% of the, get my percentage right. But anyway, a large four-fifths of native species are in decline across the West. And a lot of it is due to livestock production, both the effects on the rivers and from trampling by livestock as well as dewatering. So be aware that the grayling is like the poster child that is out there for a whole lot of other species. And the same impacts that they're different in the way that they affect each species, but it can be traced back to livestock production. So I guess I want to make people aware of look at your own situation in places where there's a decline in fish or other water-dependent species, could be frogs, could be salamanders, whatever. And ask the question, what's the ultimate source of this decline? And in a lot of cases, you'll find it's agriculture. And a lot of it is agriculture that's subsidized that probably could be produced elsewhere with far less impacts. And the second thing specifically about grayling is that you can follow along with the proceedings. The Center for Biodiversity or Western Watersheds Project both have information on their websites and updates. State of Montana has information, which, of course, you have to look at with some scrutiny, but, you know, some basic factual stuff that isn't bad that you can learn about grayling. And just realize it's just one more, it's an indicator of the overall degradation that we've imposed on the system that isn't necessary and is basically, in my view, unethical and should be corrected. And it might mean that some of the ranchers can't operate anymore. It might mean that they might have to reduce their profits, and, you know, so be it. There are other places where we can produce beef. We don't have to do it at the expense of the grayling.
Well, thank you so much for all of that, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.